If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Perspectives by John Pierce. Our topic today is tuberculosis, particularly in Pennsylvania. My guest has been with us before. He's a familiar face here at WDIY, Dr. James Higgins. Jim, welcome back to the microphones.
John, thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's do a little bit of a background on Jim. Jim, take us through your education after high school.
So all three of my degrees I earned at Pennsylvania colleges and universities. One, my undergraduate at St. Vincent, which is in La Trobe, and Duquesne. I earned my master's, and I came back to Eastern Pennsylvania, my original home, to earn my PhD at Lehigh University.
What year was that? Because WDIY began in 1995.
2009.
Okay, so we were here.
1995 was my graduation year from high school.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Oh, how young you are.
I know.
Stop bragging. Hey. So, Jim, you have always been interested in history, I guess, from a young lad?
From a very young age.
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as I can remember.
Right. So you majored in history all the way up through your schooling.
Yes.
And then you were a professor.
I was a professor, adjuncting, lecturing, and assistant professor, Rider University, University in Texas. So I've taught around lecturing at Kutztown University, which was my first job out of Lehigh. So I was a lecturer there for a number of years. So I've been around.
And you have zeroed in particularly on the history of medicine.
Yes. About 25 years ago, I zeroed in on that when I was still out at Duquesne.
So what drew you to that, do you think?
I was interested in epidemiology. And I think epidemiology functioned in a historical context as a detective story. It's a mystery. And you have to weave together various and varied pieces of evidence to knit a coherent narrative of the past. And a historian, a great historian of medicine once wrote that every epidemic is one part virus or bacteria and one part people, one part society. And until you understand both, you cannot construct a coherent narrative of what you're experiencing, what you're researching. So you can't just talk about, for instance, COVID, the virus, without talking about human reactions to it, the human immune system, how it's spread, and what sorts of factors in the human world either create optimal environment for the virus to spread and to sicken and to kill, or make it more difficult for a virus to spread, sicken, and kill.
And then also with COVID recently, in the last few years, we've seen politics sneak into this.
Of course. And politics is, you may have the technology, for instance, to prevent or cure a sickness, but especially when we're looking at a wide societal scale, political will has a lot to do with it. So my favorite example, by the end of the 19th century, we understand that bacteria cause contagious disease. We understand there are bacteria in your water supply that will sicken you and kill you, your family members, your loved ones. But the political will necessary to unlock money to build filtration plants and chlorination plants, that's where the sticky part is. Who's going to get the contracts? If there's political greasing involved, what politicians and to what degree do you have to grease them? The city of Pittsburgh, which had the worst water in all of American history, fought for 10 years between 1897 and 1908. They knew in 1897 they had to do something about the water. 10 years of traveling to Europe to look at their water chlorination and filtration plants, 10 years of bickering over who the contractors would be. And every year that they fought, hundreds of Pittsburghers, hundreds and hundreds of them died of waterborne infection. So there is a cost to not having the political will to implement these things. But politics and people, they've always walked hand in hand with disease and epidemics.
Yeah, politics, that's a very interesting point you make. The money has to come
from
political will.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, we talk about tuberculosis, and we call it, I grew up even as in the 1950s, still talking about TB.
Yes.
Take us back to the origins. How far back does it go that we actually can identify TB?
Tuberculosis has been with human beings for thousands of years. And in fact, it's quantified by most epidemiologists as the deadliest disease in human history, with 1 billion plus deaths over the last 5,000-6,000 years or so. And in very ancient burials in the what we call the Middle East today, in Asia, Europe, you can find tuberculosis lesions on bone. And so it's one way that you know it's there. And so it has probably been with us certainly in the earliest phases of Neolithic human life. And so it may be that larger concentrations of people had to come together for this disease to spread readily amongst them. But other scientists have made the point that this may have been a bacteria that was with us even before we became Homo sapiens sapien.
Oh, my goodness.
So you've got diseases that actually evolved with the human economy. So it's been around a long, long time.
Right. And you call it a bacterial disease.
A bacterial disease as opposed to a viral disease.
Right. So what's the difference between a bacterial disease and a viral disease?
So a bacteria, for kind of the layperson, you can see bacteria usually pretty readily under a simple microscope. A virus is a speck of genetic material wrapped in some sugars and proteins. And there is still at times an on-again, off-again argument about whether viruses should even be characterized as a living entity, because they appear not to do anything that a living organism does unless they're in the presence of a cell that they're going to reproduce in. Bacteria are susceptible to antibiotics, and viruses are not. Indeed, when a virus gets started on you, generally speaking, it's supportive care, treating the symptoms. And it's only been recently that you've had a number of classes of antiviral drugs come along that can either preempt or short circuit an infection with a virus that's already in your body.
Right. And we all have bacteria in our body.
You have more bacterial cells on and in your body right now than you have cells that you would label John.
Oh.
You can't digest a morsel of food without them. they keep your skin healthy. They're, you know, we like to say that bacteria specifically have been practicing chemical warfare on one another and on us for hundreds of thousands of years.
So they're necessary.
They're
for
necessary.
Our being.
They're necessary for your being. Yeah, you would die without them. Yep. Uh-huh. You'd die without them.
Whereas the virus, we could get along very well without.
You might be able to get along well without a virus. I think viruses, from my standpoint, are so, we're still unlocking the secrets. 50, 60 years ago, we had very little evidence, for instance, that viruses were involved in the development of cancer in the human body. But especially since the 1970s, we have plenty of evidence of cancers associated or originated with a viral infection. So cervical cancer, many kinds of it, for instance, begins with an infection from certain kinds of human papillomavirus. So, you know, viruses are there. They have been influencing the way that we live since our species began. And even some of our terrible bacterial diseases actually require a virus to set off the terrible chain of events. So if you get diphtheria, diphtheria will produce toxin only when it's been infected with a certain kind of bacteriophage, so a virus that specifically infects bacteria. Without that concomitant viral infection, you won't have as serious a course of illness. So viruses are very crafty. They're really, really crafty.
And so viruses sometimes work with bacteria.
Sure. And now we're using them to insert genetic material in ourselves to fight diseases, because that's what they do. They find a cell and they inject their own DNA into it. They take over the machinery of the cell and they replicate only because they hijack that cell. They're simple, but they're really complex. They're fascinating.
It is. So let's get back to tuberculosis itself. Where does the term come from?
So tuberculosis, the most oft-told story is that in the 1600s, as anatomical studies of the human body are becoming more and more common, cases of deaths from tuberculosis were autopsied, were examined. And in the lungs, these growths that looked very much like a tuber or a root, like a potato, hence tuberculosis.
Oh, yeah. The shape of them.
The shape of them, the consistency, the color, they tend to be whitish. Sounds awful, but yeah. For kind of a person looking at it for the first time, it would look rather like a gigantic whitehead, zit, in your pimple, in your lungs. Yeah. Yeah. And you can have small ones, or you can have ones that are a half an inch long and deep.
That's a large one.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where the term tuberculosis comes from. Now, you say, Jim, that by 1900 in Pennsylvania, tuberculosis was the leading cause of death.
Yeah, the only disease that held a candle to it at that time, and it's not just Pennsylvania, it's really throughout the United States. Europe's rates are a little bit lower because of some changes in some of the European societies, more food being delivered, better housing, so on and so forth. But the only bacterial caused disease that's going to kill more people is pneumonia. But pneumonia gets some help from other diseases. So it's the notion that you're older and you're sick, or you've broken a leg and you can't get around, you're on your back, and pneumonia develops. But for a direct cause of death, tuberculosis is absolutely number one. It stands peerless in the human economy at the turn of the 20th century.
All right. No longer the case?
No longer the case, no.
All right.
Although I would point out that worldwide, it is the deadliest contagious disease right now in 2025. In 2020 and 2021, it was eclipsed briefly by COVID, but it has now regained its place and outstrips COVID, influenza, and malaria.
My guest this evening on Perspectives is Dr. James Higgins, who is former professor of history and now, we didn't mention, the executive director of the Lehigh County Historical Society. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, and also a book that Jim has written called The War Against Tuberculosis. Well, this is October, and it's time for folks to be thinking about antiviral injections, right? So that's the reason I wanted to put this on the air at this time of the year. So, Jim, I assume that you are in favor of injections?
Yes, I'm a proponent of vaccinations, especially against your seasonal flu and now what will be probably for the rest of our lives, seasonal COVID.
Wow, the rest of our lives. Well, folks, while you're thinking about that, we have to take a little break here. Stay with us. You're listening to Perspectives here on WDIY. I'm John Pierce, your host. Our engineer, James Zibrot, tells me that we have to step aside for a moment. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
And we're back talking about tuberculosis with Dr. James Higgins, who has written a book called The War Against Tuberculosis, Samuel G. Dixon and the Rise of Modern Public Health in Pennsylvania. So, Jim, this book is, I'm looking here to see, it's 172 pages. And it is well documented with notes. And you also have some pictures in here.
Yes.
Tell us about the pictures.
So the book itself is a biography that I use as a vehicle to discuss how Pennsylvania went about its fight against TB in the early 20th century. And so the man at the center of it is Dr. Samuel Gibson Dixon, who was a Quaker who came from a very prominent Philadelphia family. He earned his law degree at Penn and worked as an attorney for 6 or 7 years, decided he didn't like it, and went back to Penn for his medical degree. And he was, I think, first and foremost, a research laboratory scientist. He was never in private practice as a clinician. He never worked in a hospital as a clinician, but was recognized as a very skilled physician.
And this was what era?
This is the 1880s, 1890s, when he's getting started in medicine. And it's really an accident. He is given charge right after he completes medical school of what you could argue is the first public health lab in the U.S. that University of Penn develops. And he decides to go over to Europe. And at the time, in the late 19th, early 20th century, most aggressive, ambitious American physicians would finish their schooling in Europe, not here.
Oh.
And it's the European labs and the European really clinical and laboratory geniuses that Americans want to tap into. So he goes over to a couple of labs in England, and in one of these labs, he pulls a test tube out of an incubator, and he knows it contains TB bacteria. And he looks at it under the microscope, and these bacteria don't look right. They've got branches shooting out of them. And the branching is indicative of what scientists call attenuation. It is stressing the bacteria. And the idea is you stress the bacteria. What makes the bacteria say TB remains, but some of its more virulent portions will no longer be virulent.
Well, when Dr. Dixon saw this, he was the first to
See
that.
Yeah.
So he didn't know what he was looking at.
He didn't know what he was looking at. And he kind of kept his mouth shut and didn't tell the prominent scientist, this man, Klein, what he had found. And the next day, he pulls another test tube out of the same incubator and looks at it again just to make sure what he's seeing is right, because he doesn't want to embarrass himself in front of all these people. And what he'll discover before he discusses this with Dr. Klein and the rest of the students, and these are already doctors, so these are kind of postdoctoral, post-MD awarded, mostly men who are doing extra laboratory work. And he finds that incubator had been used for a variety of things, but it had not been kept at a constant temperature. At times, the front of it would be hit with sunlight. And so the environment that the bacteria was in was very hostile. So he says to Dr. Klein, look underneath this microscope. And Klein says, if this branching is true, you've made a great scientific discovery. He publishes this discovery in a very small medical journal out of Philadelphia, and that probably hurts him going forward. The crux of it is that in 1882, one of the greatest physician, scientist, researchers in all of human history, the great German Robert Koch, he is able to prove that a single bacteria, TB, causes the disease that we know of as tuberculosis in people. It's the first time that anyone's ever able to prove that this disease in a human being comes from a particular bacteria.
And that's 1882.
And then Koch falls flat and does nothing until the fall of 1889, I contend, when he read and when he received a letter from Dixon. And the letter says, it's down at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, essentially, I've been able to attenuate TB and the tuberculosis bacteria, and my next step is to induce immunity in guinea pigs. Well, over the next 7 months, 8 months, Robert Koch works tirelessly with a very small team. One of the people was his son-in-law. This is a team that he trusted not to leak any information out from the University of Berlin. And in the August 1890 tuberculosis conference, he announces that he has a cure for it called tuberculin. But he will not release its constituents. He will not release how it's made. people in Germany especially begin to shoot it into their patients. Doctors do, but they don't know what they're working with. And the reality is, what you see over and over again is that latent TB infections become active and people start to die. It discredits and disgraces him. But in the midst of all this, Dixon's able to prove that he induced immunity in guinea pigs even before Robert Koch, because Robert Koch is not mentioning Dixon's name. He is not giving him any credit for the experimentation that leads to Koch's fluid. So Koch is frankly disgraced. He has to admit that he had a human subject field of two people, himself and his 17-year-old mistress. He shot both of them up with tuberculin, and actually she'll relate later on that he said, well, I don't think it's going to kill you. And that was his human testing before he released it to physicians. He thought he was going to make a lot of money from it. Instead, if you boil down his career, and there are a number of other great things he does, it really comes down to discovery of what causes TB and then this debacle with tuberculin. Tuberculin, probably everybody listening to this radio program has had it shot into them. It is the fluid that's put under your arm for a TB test. And so what we find is that is a great diagnostic tool, but it's not a treatment. And so because Dixon did not want to experiment with people until he was sure his own fluid wouldn't cause an acceleration of the disease, he spared that because he's frankly much more careful with human life and health than Robert Koch was. And so this then becomes the topic that obsesses Dixon till the day he dies in February of 1918. He'll never leave tuberculosis behind.
What a story. And especially interesting to know that physicians in this country would finish their medical studies in Europe, typically.
Overseas, yep.
And typically either England, Germany, France.
Yep, those are the three big ones. Those are the three big ones.
And you say, Jim, that in the early 20th century, there is a drop in illnesses, and I guess you're talking tuberculosis here,
yeah,
in the U.S. for two reasons at least.
Yes. So we have – one reason it probably drops is that you've got nutrition and better housing. So we are – tuberculosis is very much a disease that is able to feed on vulnerable populations. So at the height of the AIDS epidemic, for instance, in Africa and Asia, in most countries, your number one cause of death of HIV patients was TB. And TB infects more people and a higher percentage of the Earth's population in 2025 than it ever has throughout human history. So it's a very present illness. But another thing that probably causes it to drop, rather than just the bettering of environmental conditions, that includes nutrition, things like that, is that we are isolating more and more tuberculosis patients. And in Pennsylvania, retrospective analysis indicates that there probably was a drop because of the formation, the construction of these very large tuberculosis hospitals at three locations, relatively remote locations in the state. And so people who are in end-stage tuberculosis are extraordinarily capable of spreading the disease, because the disease, if it's pulmonary, is breaking down the lungs. The lungs are swarming with this bacteria. And every time the TB sufferer, not so much the speaking or the breathing, but the coughing, the hacking, you are spraying out hundreds of thousands, millions of tuberculosis bacteria into the air, onto surfaces, and into the lungs of other people. And if you combine that problem, for instance, with a poor family that's living in a home that has no windows or very few windows, and then you compound that with a cold Pennsylvania winter coming in where you are shutting every possible entrance to your apartment or to your little home. And where does the family gather? Together around a heat source, whether that's a stove or a fireplace. So in those conditions, you know, TB isn't like the common cold. It takes repeated exposure for you to have the bacteria access your lungs and begin an infection. And so breathing and rebreathing air that's contaminated with the bacteria is kind of a magic carpet into your lungs for that pathogen. And most people will acquire TB and your body will wall it off in the lungs, and it becomes this tiny little speck that you can see on an x-ray. But otherwise, you know, you can live 30 or 40 years and die happily of something other than TB. But if during the course of your life you suffer stressors, and those stressors can be a chronic illness, an acute serious illness, time spent in the army, pregnancy, any of these things that stress your body can then weaken the immune system and allow the bacteria to break out. And so you go from having a latent infection, which doesn't harm you and it doesn't harm anyone else, to an active infection. And that's the infection that once it gets going, minus the presence of antibiotics, you've got a 95 or 96% chance of dying 100, 120, 130 years ago of the disease. Essentially, if you've got an active tuberculosis infection, you're going to die, and you're going to die in about 60 months.
So improved diet and also isolating the people. And you said three major hospitals.
Three major hospitals.
In the state. And also the issue of ventilation.
Yeah.
In the places where we lived were the reasons that we started to see a drop in TB. And in the 1940s, we have the start of antibiotics.
Right. So it's a watershed. It's a watershed. Every major city would have had in, say, 1945 or 1946, a tuberculosis farm and hospital, and then probably also a separate infectious disease hospital. And by the early 1950s, these are all shutting down, whether it's the general infectious disease hospitals or the tuberculosis dedicated ones, because of the advent first in the 1930s of sulfa drugs. Those are our first antibiotics, not penicillin. Sulfa drugs first. And they're still used today. Penicillin in the early 1940s, and then you have streptomycin come out, and then a whole host of them. And once that later class, the streptomycins come out, you've got a tool that is readily effective against TB. But what it can't do is reverse the damage that TB, an active infection, has already done to your body. So in the same, you know, the case of syphilis, if you begin to have neurologic degeneration from a syphilis infection, if it's caught, then you can stop that progression, but you can never reverse it. So the damage done is the damage done.
All right. So much information about tuberculosis, bacterial disease that is contagious. And Jim, I think I heard you say that even this year, it's the biggest killer in certain parts of the world.
Yes, it's the biggest killer in Asia, Africa. You have pockets of real lethality in South and Central America. And the cases that we know of, and whether we're talking about morbidity or mortality, but especially the latter, TB has probably evolved in a lot more than we think. Because if you're living in an area of the world where your diagnostic tools are few and far between, then it looks like a classic case of TB consumption. You get very, very thin, you waste away, and then either another infection or reduced ability to exchange oxygen in the bloodstream, or the eroding of pulmonary arteries that leads to a vast internal bleed in your lungs and your chest cavity results.
My guest this evening has been Dr. James Higgins. And the book is titled The War Against Tuberculosis, Samuel G. Dixon and the Rise of Modern Public Health in Pennsylvania. Jim, our time is up.
Well, it's been a wonderful time with you, John. It always is.
Thank you. Jim's a big supporter of WDIY 88.1 FM. Another big supporter is James Zibrot. James, thanks for your good work on the board. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in, and you have learned a lot about tuberculosis this evening. I'm John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.